This week on Past Gas, we're talking about Cadillac Part 2. This is not the good years we're talking about. We are talking about Hailfins 2 nowadays. So there are a bunch of different eras. The land yacht era of the 70s, the crazy long ones. And then there's some years where they don't really hit the mark. And then they find their stride again, but it's with an unusual car that they don't usually make. What is that car? We'll find out this week on Cadillac Part 2. Let's get into it. During the first three quarters of the 20th century, Cadillac was the luxury vehicle of choice for presidents and movie stars. These land yachts were celebrated in pop songs by iconic artists like Aretha Franklin, Bruce Springsteen, and The Clash. But by the mid-90s, Cadillac was in a sad state. Cars had lost half their market share, and it wasn't even clear whether General Motors should continue making them. Today on Past Gas, what forces nearly killed America's premier auto marquee? How did it bounce back? And what does the future hold for caddies and their daddies? It's the history of Cadillac Part 2. Let's go! We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Let's go.
The Clash.
Caddies and their daddies.
I love The Clash.
Oh, yeah. Name three songs.
Rock the Casbah.
Great song.
Whoa. Yeah,
totally.
That song that MIA sampled.
Yep. that one. And
One more. You got this.
I know it's on the tip of my tongue.
This is so embarrassing.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
I know.
I'm so.
Let's just cut all this out.
No.
Keep it in. Keep it in.
Quick.
You need to know what a fraud Jimmy is.
I just like Rock the Casbah. Okay.
Yeah. Sure.
I just like Rock. That's a great song.
Who doesn't like that song?
I like that song a lot.
That voice you hear being a fraud is Jimmy Hilton.
I ain't no fraud. I'm just telling the truth.
And joined with us is also Christina Felsky.
Hi, you can hear me laughing from miles away.
And I'm Joe Weber. Welcome to Past Gas.
Yay.
This is fun. We left off last week in quotations.
It was also last week.
Mm-hmm. Really?
It was.
I believe.
Oh my God,
it was last week. It's been a week.
It's been a week.
This week's been a month.
Yeah.
It's been a movie, dude.
This week's been a movie. My life is a movie.
Every single week, I'm like, I just need to get through this week.
Yeah.
And I realize I've been saying that for about 5 years. And I'm like, I should make some changes.
Every Friday feels the same. I can't catch a break.
How was your weekend, Jimmy?
Great. You know, hung out, got sushi, got engaged.
Oh my God!
It was great.
Tell the story.
It was awesome.
I'm so excited. I knew that was gonna happen. Sorry, my levels are insane. I just let out a scream only dogs can hear. I'm so excited.
It was awesome. We had a really good day. It was the last day of summer, so I made a promise to her that I would propose to her by the end of summer.
Oh my God. Classic procrastinator.
Yeah. I got down on one knee, opened up the box, and it was the wrong way up. The ring was
<that's>
towards you?
Really funny,
it was
though.
Well, I opened it up
with
and the ring was
stone down.
Stone down. I was like, a little flustered in the moment.
Sure.
We literally kept making a joke that Jimmy was going to drop the ring in the sand.
Oh.
So I was like, oh, you have to tie a fishing line to it and then tie it to your belt.
Oh, I didn't do it at the beach. I did it in front of my parents' house.
Okay, that's way
better.
My
parents' house overlooks the Pacific Ocean.
The original idea was to do it on the rocks at the beach. And we're like, you're never going to see that ring again.
Yeah. You're going to
I'm glad I didn't do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and Gabe shot photos for it.
So cute.
Great.
Yeah, he was on my parents' balcony sniping.
Oh, man.
God, that's so cute.
So it's great.
And she saw him, and you were like, no, that's just our gardener taking pictures of the flowers.
On a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
No, I know you've met Gabe several times because we've worked with him for years, but no, it's yeah.
Yeah, funny enough, she met Gabe in Australia.
Oh, weird.
When we went down there.
Yeah.
But it was great. I'm
so
stoked.
Cute.
We went and got sushi afterwards.
Jimmy's grown up.
Now it's weird. I'm like, we're not boyfriend and girlfriend anymore.
She's your fiance.
My fiance.
Oh, yes. Nice.
So that's the running joke right now.
Yes.
I'm like, oh, the first time we've been home. as fiancés.
Yes. Yeah.
First time it feels
different. It does.
Yeah.
It does feel different.
That's so cool. Similarly, off camera, Audrey got married this week.
Yeah, congrats.
Yeah. So congrats to Audrey. Audrey is our researcher, writer for Big Three, and does the board here. And
everybody's grown up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except for me. I bought a ticket to Portugal.
Nice. Hell yeah.
I'm going to Portugal for Thanksgiving because I don't have a family.
Oh.
Do they have turkey in Portugal?
No.
No turkey.
And that's good because I don't like it.
Oh.
And it's my favorite holiday to skip. And I've skipped it the last couple of years and gone to like a 5-star meal on Thanksgiving Day
in a different
country.
I like doing a steak on Thanksgiving.
Hell yeah, dude.
I don't like Thanksgiving turkey.
I don't either.
It's too dry.
It's never good.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever had it good.
The only reason it's good is because you toss a ton of gravy on it.
Yeah.
True.
You know? I love gravy though.
Yeah.
And if the gravy's subpar, then like.
I can see you loving Thanksgiving.
I love Thanksgiving because I love going overboard with cooking.
And that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. I usually cook 6 or 7 things, and people are also bring stuff to it. So we did our new thing. Our family does Feast of 7 Fishes for Christmas now.
Oh,
which we just started doing. It's like an Italian thing. But
that's fun.
I think I cooked 7 myself last year. We had like 12 fishes, and everyone was like, this is too many fish.
If I may.
It's midday.
If I may share a story about Joe, after his son was born, he invited me to dinner at his house. And I was like, oh, great. What can I bring? He's like, nothing. I'm cooking. And I showed up and he cooked a gourmet ass meal. And I'm like, you have a 2-week-old baby. But yes, thank you for this amazing chicken that I will think about for weeks.
I don't think I've ever had any of Joe's cooking.
Oh,
really?
Oh,
no, not even at the barbecue. When you barbecued here.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Going back to our road trip snacks segment, I brought something.
Oh.
I have one thing that we can test and then one thing that we can compare it to. I know it's already going long. Mm-hmm. You guys listening on audio format, you're like, get to the story. I want to hear about the CTSV.
We want the gas.
But let's do this really quick.
Okay. And you can press that 30-second ahead button. Don't be shy.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Don't be shy.
This is... something from my childhood.
Oh my God.
I feel honored.
From your, as a millennial, you're going to appreciate this.
Don't call me out. I'm just kidding.
Teddy Grahams.
Oh, love Teddy Grahams.
For a road trip snack, let's talk about how easy they are to eat.
That is easy to open.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. And I'm drinking coffee still, so this is a perfect. Mine has one leg.
Real cocoa.
Zoom in, Mark.
And these are not.
Zoom in, Mark.
These are not great. The. Normal cinnamon ones. These are cocoa ones, which are not my favorite.
No, they're not very good.
They taste like burnt coffee to me. And I haven't had them in years, but I want to confirm that.
You know what? They taste like dog
treats.
Yeah.
I feel like I need a glass of water now.
We both know that, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
have you eaten a dog treat before?
Yeah.
I have too.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, right?
They're human grade food.
Yeah. I think my favorite has to be Bonios.
No.
Don't know if you've had those.
You've had more than one.
I've tried a few. Yeah.
You got to try a couple.
You don't have a tier list?
No, I've only had a milk bone, and then I ate it as a joke, and then I was like, not bad.
And then
my friend and I finished the box.
Right?
What would you rate this at? Ease of eating, taste, mess that it makes. How would you rate this for a road trip snack?
I just don't really like it, so I would say low.
I wouldn't. If I go into a gas station, I'm not getting those.
I'm a woman of extremes, so I'm going to say f***ing zero.
Whoa. I'm they're not my thing.
Not your thing? 0, 2?
Yeah, I'll do 0.
I'm going to give it a 2. If it was cinnamon.
There we go.
If it was cinnamon, I would give it like a 4.
Yeah. Mm. I like animal
in
crackers.
Contrast.
Oh my God.
This is Emily's famous cookie recipe.
Oh my God, I'm so excited.
What is this? Chocolate chip?
Thank you.
Chocolate chip, there's oats in it.
Oh. Oh, wow. You can really feel the
flavor. It's so good. I'm mad you shared it.
This tastes a little bit like a Anzac cookie.
What's that?
It's an Australian cookie. Mm. They like are made with oats, I think, and they like never go bad. Because Anzac is the military in Australia, and they would send them to the troops.
Mm.
So they wouldn't go bad. That's one of my favorite cookies.
This is freaky good.
Yeah.
I really like it.
I like it
I would like more.
Oh, well, tell Emily because she'll make you a million batches.
I know. That was a mistake.
So those are some, those are examples of some snacks that you could eat in your Cadillac. Should we jump into it?
Let's jump right in.
In the early 1970s, Cadillac was still riding a hot streak that went virtually all the way back to its founding. The Eldorado convertible was perhaps the most iconic 70s Cadillac, but other models like the stylish Coupe de Ville and the enormous Fleetwood were also favorites among the American elite. But the 1980s were not so kind. Hair metal was in and long, wide sedans were out. The market for luxury vehicles was actually growing, but trends were changing as well. Europe's command of other luxury markets like watches and apparel helped influence rising sales of Mercedes and BMW in the US. Meanwhile, other forces began threatening General Motors and the American auto industry more generally.
Those companies realized, like, wait, there's other automakers? Wait, outside of the U.S.?
Us. I thought this was an old boys club.
Oh.
This included antitrust threats, a wave of reliable Japanese imports, the 1974 oil crisis, and the first fuel economy regulations, the CAFE regulations.
Yeah, that's quite a few massive things put into one sentence, huh?
A lot of things working against Cadillac this time.
A sandwich, yes. If you might, of wrong things.
Yeah, shit sandwich, except... this time the bread's made out of shit too.
Yeah.
And Cadillac's got to eat it all.
Yeah. And there's four layers.
Oh, it's a club sandwich.
Antitrust threats. A wave of reliable Japanese imports.
Yeah. Mm.
The oil crisis.
That's where you get that smoky flavor.
And fuel economy regulations.
Yeah.
I want to be clear that we all remember those.
And a little.
I'm going to ask at the end.
A little toothpick.
I'm not. I'm not. They're
all layers.
Yes. A little bit of mayonnaise.
The mayonnaise is diarrhea.
Stop. We're done.
Oh, no, I'm not eating lunch.
God, I can't imagine listening to this podcast as you're driving. You're like, oh, my God, get to the point. Now they're chewing food in a microphone. And now they're talking about diarrhea. These people.
All right, let me get back to this story.
No! Okay.
Cadillac was slow to adapt to these changes. Car buff books and media observers began to write the brand off for dead. GM's solution to many of these problems was to engineer, quote, common solutions across their many brands. GM was the largest car company on the planet, but organized in a way that left many redundancies. Company executives embraced an overhaul that they hoped would reduce the number of different vehicle platforms and parts in production across the globe, most especially in the US. So they're trying to do more shared platforms. Mm-hmm. I think the Chrysler K platform is a good example of this.
They wanted to go back to the parts bin, like they were in part one.
Yeah.
You know, they only had like one car pretty much, right? And they were just using the same parts across all of them.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And then like they would rely on coach builders to do different stuff with the body of it, but... one of the most significant changes GM undertook was the move to nearly all of its passenger cars from rear-wheel drive to a lighter, cheaper, and more fuel-efficient front-wheel drive platform.
Oh.
Jimmy's favorite.
Oh.
But this meant engines and transmissions would also necessarily have to change, so that almost every part of every General Motors car was changing at once. Many of the new front-wheel drive vehicles ended up with quality problems. Even the ones that didn't were noticeably smaller and lighter than previous GM models, which confused and disappointed longtime customers, particularly if you were used to driving a 225-inch long Caddy. That's nuts.
That's big.
That's a big honker, dude. That's over 20 feet long, isn't it?
Yeah. That boats are big. That's the size of a boat.
That's a schooner.
Yeah, you are right.
I'm thinking about buying a boat, and that's not a joke.
Oh, really?
I'm with you there.
Thinking about buying a real cheap boat. Don't know.
I want a Chris Craft. That's what I want.
Fun.
I want to find an old Chris Craft from like the 50s.
That's hot though, dude.
Do a little wooden restoration on it.
Oh, yeah. That's where I know that.
And
name.
Then park it in Marina Del Rey.
Dude, I can't believe Jimmy just one-upped me so
I love boats.
Yeah, by knowing the name of boat.
Yeah,
I didn't,
name
I
three
don't know.
Boats, Christina.
No.
Chris Craft.
Chris Craft.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
I would, yes, that sounds very cool.
I just need space.
I know, right? Yeah.
That's what we all need.
What if I just like put my boat in the pool in my building? I wonder how long. What do you think would happen? I wonder how long it would take for them to
technically
be like,
don't I have a parking spot here that I could?
Allegedly.
Yeah. I'm going to put my boat here.
That's a.
No.
You can buy a boat too.
No, I don't want a boat. No one, no one should have a boat.
No, we're going to get boats.
Yeah, I'm going to get a boat.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Speaking of land boats,
yes.
GM's overall struggles also meant that none of its individual brands had the money or design capacity to meaningfully differentiate themselves. This led to compromises like the Cadillac Cimarron, which was basically a Chevy Cavalier with leather seats. That's a tiny Cadillac then. If yeah. Cavalier was like a two-seater.
Yeah.
Or a two-door. Sorry.
Two-door with back seats. Yeah.
A two plus two. Journalist Dan Neal included the Cimarron on his list of the worst cars of all time,
oh,
calling it, quote,
a flagrant insult to the good name and fine customers of Cadillac.
The Cimarron's failure helped sully Cadillac's luxury reputation as its U.S. market share fell 170%.
I don't think this car is that ugly. Is that bad? Am I in trouble for that?
Possibly.
Okay.
I don't like this thing.
I don't love it, but it's not as bad as I expected it to be for how much how maligned. Maybe it's like, just like performance-wise as shit.
Mm-hmm. This is this is NPC car for sure.
Oh, 1,000,000%. That is
NPC.
True. But I like boxy, and it's pretty boxy.
It is boxy. I like the fog lights in the front. Mm. That's about it.
Mm-hmm. This is something you would expect an undercover cop to drive.
Yeah.
This is the type of car that in movies gets blown up.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
It's one we could launch off a cliff in Alaska if we wanted
like
to.
Like some mid-level muscle guy is getting blown
up. Oh my god.
His car.
Yeah.
And he's got, he's in the window before. No.
Yeah. Boss. Prune face didn't make it. He was blown up outside of Lancer's Deli.
Not Lancer's Deli.
Yeah.
Did they get any shrapnel in the deli?
Yeah, yeah, all of the pastrami.
No!
Despite the fact that GM was selling 40% fewer cars than it used to and was $70 billion in debt, in the mid-1990s, the company still had a somewhat ridiculous seven marquees under its umbrella. Cadillac, Buick, Oldsmobile, Chevy, GMC, Pontiac, and Saturn. In 1998, they acquired Hummer to make it eight.
We're already in debt. Let's buy another one.
Yeah, but Hummer's for sale.
Hummer.
Yeah.
No one will get sick of these.
Was that in 1998?
We're
going
to live forever.
Well, they made like 10 a year back then, so.
Well, also you have to think about the military contract.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? That's a good point.
The military contract will make them money.
I was just thinking about me and Joe and how many there were in Wisconsin. There were a lot.
There was, really?
Mm-hmm. They all had to support our troops magnets.
Oh.
My uncle had one. He had an H2.
There was a guy, like a science guy that drove around Milwaukee. Like going to schools doing science, and he had his big Hummer.
Would he open up the Hummer and the science trays would come out?
Yeah, and there'd be like beakers and a little volcano that did it like vinegar. And
this was in the Hummer,
baking, you know.
I know, but is this a bit or is this real?
This is real.
That's so weird.
He lived behind my cousin's restaurant for a long time, and then
what?
Sorry.
Lance's Deli.
Yeah, no, Sala. You can check them out if you live in Wisconsin.
Really good food.
Yeah.
Really good food. Really, really good food.
So basically, no other manufacturer offered more than three brands, and most offered only one or two.
Mm.
To help navigate these issues, the GM board brought Jack Smith in to be its president and CEO.
What a name.
Mm-hmm.
Cool name.
Yeah.
I mean, that's NPC.
I'm Jack Smith. Do you want to accept this quest? His arrival further hurt Cadillac in two ways. First, he focused on revitalizing GM's truck offerings. Trucks were proving to be more profitable than sedans at the time and also faced less onerous fuel standards. But Cadillac didn't make trucks. Second, Smith brought in an advertising executive named Ron Zarella to overhaul GM's branding. Zarella decided to focus on marketing models like the Blazer instead of makes like Chevrolet. But the Cadillac was a brand unto itself, and the plan ultimately hurt the luxury car maker more than it helped.
Mm.
A conundrum.
All right, you guys ready for another name?
Yeah, let me just eat another burnt coffee.
I don't know why you're
flavored graham cracker.
Yeah, just chew directly into the microphone. Okay, are you guys ready? Because I had to check and make sure this person's name is right. All right. In February 1997, Smith and Zarella hired John Smith, not the same as Jack Smith, different.
That'll come into play later, though. I was like, these guys are, I'm going to confuse the shit out of these guys. It will.
That's fun. Okay, very exciting. Anyway, so they hired John Smith to be the new general manager of the Cadillac brand. Smith came over from running GM's distinctly unluxurious Allison Transmission division.
What a division to be in.
I mean, maybe don't name it Allison.
Why?
Boring.
Plain. Did you ever see The Dictator with Sacha Baron Cohen? He has a really funny, he's like trying to be undercover and he gets to New York.
Oh, Allison.
Allison Burgers. They're like, what's your name? And he drives past like Tom's Burgers. He's like, Allison Burgers. It's really funny.
For the record, I don't know if people are still naming kids Allison. So that's interesting. We'll see. We'll find out.
Yeah.
We'll find out when Wyatt goes to school.
Oh, your beef is with the name Allison.
Yeah, that's the lore now. Christina hates Allisons. I don't even talk to Allisons.
Wow.
When an Allison shows up, I'm like, no. Okay. So Smith came over from running GM's distinctly unluxurious Allison Transmission division, but his fresh eyes proved to be a good fit for reinventing Cadillac. In his memoir, Fin Tales, God, he writes,
not to be confused with Shark Tales. Yeah,
totally different. And no Angelina Jolie.
Yeah.
He wrote,
we started our reimagining work by looking inward at the brand's history and what had made it unique and successful for most of Cadillac's first century. Styling was a big part of this, but the brand also boasted a long and well-documented list of technological firsts.
Early on, Smith decided that the Cadillac needed an SUV. Luxury SUVs were a growing market segment, and he felt that Cadillac had to do something fresh to show its customers it wasn't an irrelevant brand. However, this vision was in conflict with the overall plan for GM. Ron Zarella was still focusing on differentiating the 60-plus models on offer. Oh my God.
That's a lot.
So many.
Way too many. Cut that down.
Cut it. Cut that down. What this meant in practice was that he wanted Cadillac to sell only luxury cars. Chevrolet already sold premium versions of their trucks, and any luxury trucks that GM might develop in the future were set to be sold under the GMC brand. In fact, John Smith learned that his predecessor had proposed a Cadillac SUV in 1995 and was denied on these grounds.
Mm-hmm.
However, over his years at Allison Transmission, John Smith had developed a working relationship with Zarella's boss, GM CEO Jack Smith. This is insane. Come on. Mainly because their mail would get misdelivered to each other.
Right? Isn't that funny? So funny.
It's little things like this that
change the world, I
change
guess.
Change the world.
Yeah.
This confusion developed into a casual friendship, and 6 months after arriving at Cadillac, John went over Zarella's head and mentioned the truck idea to Jack.
I bet Zarella didn't like that.
Such a casual friendship thing.
Yeah.
Boy.
Hey, I got your mail. Also, would you let me make a truck? Let me make a truck.
It was enough to get the ball rolling. GM may have also seen Lincoln's early success with the Navigator and concluded that a Cadillac SUV was inevitable.
The Navigator was hot at this time. Yes. I remember my cousin Rita had one, and I was like, damn, that's a good-looking SUV.
Hmm.
It looked luxury at the time.
Hmm. Well, if nothing else, John Smith had a wild card in his back pocket that helped to get the GM executives on board. GMC and Chevy branded trucks were sold at an 18% dealer discount, but more expensive Cadillacs were sold at 11%, boosting profit by 7% without lifting a finger.
Ooh, it's all about the numbers.
Yeah. Money, money, money.
Bean counters.
Smith got the okay to start developing a Cadillac SUV under the direction of GM design chief Wayne Cherry. Shut up.
What are these names?
Who are these men?
Oh my God, the next one's really funny.
I know.
Are you kidding me?
Cherry and designer Terry Henline. I don't know why these are getting me so good.
These are not real people.
It's close to hemline. I think that's why. But also, just a line of chickens. Okay, yeah. So Cherry and designer Terry Henline used the GMC Yukon as a starting point. But due to a short timeline and minuscule budget, they had little creative freedom. Cherry now describes the truck's only unique qualities as just a grill and small badging. The front end was a simple, large chrome oval with the Cadillac wreath and crest set against a matte black grill insert. Cherry's team added a few other Cadillac-specific touches. Chrome wheels, the brand name in large block letters at eye level for anyone in a passenger car, and Cadillac-specific leather seating. Another sandwich!
That's great marketing
uh-huh.
to put it at eye level for any other car.
Yeah, that's like what they do in grocery stores.
Yeah.
That's smart.
Huh, I think I should buy a Cadillac SUV.
Hmm.
It's at my eye level.
The most unique thing about it actually had nothing to do with Cadillac itself. Smith set up a deal to outfit each SUV with a snazzy little information and communication device called OnStar. This was the second generation of OnStar hardware, but the first came with a clunky handset that consumers hated. Cadillac managed to be the first car company with a hands-free communication and safety system.
That's cool. Remember wanting this as a kid. I was going to say reason. That.
I thought this really? Was so cool.
Yeah, because you could just be like, OnStar, I crashed and my legs are gone.
Yeah.
And like someone would come and get you.
Yeah. I thought this was the truly the future, like Jetson style.
Yeah.
What year is this?
I remember if like OnStar was in Australia.
See, yeah, because late 90s, we didn't have phones.
Yeah.
Really?
So
you had
like,
car phone if you were like super rich.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like.
I forgot that like at the time, or you know, like when you're a kid, you're like, oh, walkie talkie with my best friend and his house would be the coolest thing. This is like a walkie talkie.
Yeah.
But for people who can come find your legs after they get
chopped
off.
It also had stolen vehicle tracking.
Every day of my life, I hoped for a cute neighbor boy to live next door and we'd have tin cans across windows. Anyway,
it can still happen.
I hope. Griffin does live in my building.
Oh, you could set up.
I could set up something with Griffin.
And it would not impede like any maybe no. someone walking right
would,
past you.
I mean, I would hit my, I would strangle myself. It's yeah. only would impede
you'd
me.
Get wrapped around.
Yeah, I'd get stuck in it.
This one time.
And then he'd keep asking me to borrow my vacuum, so. I don't need him to have an easier way of doing that.
Yeah.
You could invent a pulley system.
Yeah.
Oh, that's another thing I wanted as a kid, like
system.
A bucket.
Yeah.
And you could go to your treehouse. Oh.
I know. I wanted a treehouse still want a treehouse.
You know who had probably a really cool treehouse? Zach Jobe.
Dude, I bet.
Guarantee it.
I bet.
Like
that's probably true.
Yeah, he had a cool treehouse.
Oh, man.
With a cool pulley system.
Yeah.
And he probably had a tin can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Damn. Anyway.
That's the life right
that
there.
That is the life. That is the life. That's the one we all wanted.
I don't want a $2 million house. I want a tree house with a pulley system.
Truly.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Big thanks to Yamaha for sponsoring this podcast. Life's an adventure. Time to let more people in on the fun and share the journey. Introducing Yamaha's latest terrain conquering side-by-side that combines class-leading power with maximum comfort and versatility. The all-new Wolverine R-Max 4 1000 has ample room for four adult passengers, plus plenty of cargo space so you can tackle new terrain, expand your horizons, and go further than ever before. Side-by-sides are so fun, and Yamaha is so reliable. If you like doing outdoors stuff, this is such a fun vehicle for you and your family. Like I said, it can fit up to four full adults. That's you and three of your boys or your wife and her friends. It's so fun. So go to your Yamaha dealership, test drive one of these things. You're not going to regret it. Experience its capability at yamahamotorsports.com and see your local dealer today. Always protect the environment and wear your seatbelt, helmet, eye protection, and protective clothing. Read the owner's manual and product warning labels before operation. Thanks, Yamaha.
Now back to the show.
Smith still needed a name for his SUV. Working with ad agencies and legal advisors, he landed on a French word meaning the scaling of fortified ramparts. Escalade.
God. That's what that means?
I guess.
That's cool.
I mean,
never going to look at an Escalade the same now.
I'm also, it's a scaling of fortified ramparts. Okay.
That's
he felt cool. The name fit Cadillac's French history and also seemed to convey something rising, which was a good omen for Cadillac's unexpected entry into the luxury SUV market.
That's why I named my car Boner.
Just stop. Which one? The one you drive with your child?
Oh, God.
That car?
Joe.
No.
That car, Joe?
My Z.
Okay, great.
Yeah, Zoner.
Zoner.
Boat.
All right. Yeah, let's move on.
My vanity plate is crazy.
The Escalade was an immediate success. GM invested just $10 million in its development and returned around $200
Whoa.
Million in Damn. Profit over the first-gen Escalade's two-year existence.
That's a lot of Miatas.
Yeah.
Wow.
It took them 10, first of all, that's a very low amount to develop a
yes.
brand new car.
Yeah.
But also a lot of money to just be like, leather? New badge?
Yeah.
Right?
That is true.
Grill?
Grill?
With that success, the second generation was allowed much greater engineering and financial flexibility. This brought more horsepower, a better driveline, bigger wheels, unique styling, and other chassis technology improvements.
Rims real big. Everything real big.
House real big.
Rich bitch, I'm a real big timer.
You didn't listen to the big timers back then?
No.
No.
The Escalade quickly found an eager new generation of athletes, musicians, like what you just did, movie stars, and limo operations. What a way to end the
also,
sentence.
Also, I don't know if you guys know the skater Chad Muska. He was a big deal.
I feel like you reference him once a week.
Really? I also believe you do.
He's
one
of my heroes.
In the same exact way.
He was known for grinding handrails with a big boombox on his shoulder.
That's pretty cool. Right.
And he had a Cadillac?
He had one that he had changed to. So his name was Chad Muska. He had some badge changed to Cadillac Muscalade.
Nice.
And I thought that was so good.
You should get him on the pod.
I would love him. He he's a big hero of mine.
That'd be great.
Could probably hit him up through Bucky, maybe. They are both in Tony Hawk's Pro Skater.
Oh, nice.
Very fun. In one fell swoop, Cadillac managed to regain a big chunk of the cultural cachet and sales it had lost. Plus, Escalade owners were 12 years younger than other Cadillac owners and made 25% more money. But perhaps more importantly, Cadillac was back on the radio.
You know who owned a Escalade?
Who?
Tony Soprano.
Did he really?
Yeah, in the later seasons. He has an Escalade.
Oh, gabagoo. Yeah.
And then it sold, I think, at auction, the Escalade.
There's this part, it was definitely on a podcast when James and Nolan were, where Nolan was watching Sopranos.
Yeah.
And he thought this theme song was get up in the morning, get some gabagool.
Oh, because he heard the donkey parody of it.
Yeah, because James would sing it all the time.
Yeah.
And then he was like, I thought it was the theme song.
Grab some gabagool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think about that, how Nolan thought that was real almost once a week.
That's really funny.
Like, I think it's legit so funny. Yeah. Okay.
Tony Soprano is inherently funny.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. The Cadillac, though, the Escalade, sold for $175,000.
Damn.
Yeah, the screen car. So that's cool.
Tahoe.
Yeah. But it has his signature on it.
Mm.
But the second-gen Escalade became GM's second most profitable model behind the Corvette and also produced a majority of Cadillac's profits. This success brought John Smith and his team a lot of goodwill inside GM, enabling them to take risks on other investments in the Cadillac brand, like an all-new rear-wheel drive architecture for their cars. Smith's team came up with an idea they called Art and Science to guide the future of Cadillac vehicles.
They named it after a New York Times section?
They named it after a school.
That's how sophisticated it is.
Mm.
It was focused on the trends they expected to define future luxury vehicle consumers. Namely, they thought that car buyers would care most about personal safety, staying connected, the environment, and an appreciation for details and the appearance of craftsmanship.
Ooh, we like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we love craftsmanship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we have an appreciation for details and staying connected. Mm-hmm.
And the environment.
And personal safety.
They get us. Cadillac also took inspiration from Harley-Davidson, another classic American brand that fell on hard times but managed to revive itself.
True.
Smith noticed that Harley actively celebrated its iconic past and felt Cadillac could do the same. With their mind on the future, they also decided that boomers who had gotten used to European luxury marquees were unlikely to be won back to Cadillac. So they focused their design and marketing efforts on the Escalade crowd, Gen X and younger, us millennials.
Yeah.
Not you, though, Jimmy.
Not me.
Are you not?
I'm 96, so cusp.
You're cusper.
You're saying you're 96 years old.
I am 96 years old. I got that Benjamin Button syndrome.
I already can see the cut. They're going to be like, how is Jimmy engaged?
Yeah.
Yeah. People are still like, isn't he like 16?
You're like, can he
drive?
No,
dude, Jimmy is like silent generation.
I don't know how to use this goddamn thing.
I need print a PDF.
Dude, Jimmy asks us to fax shit for him constantly.
Why does my fax not work, Bob?
Most important to John Smith was returning to rear-wheel drive for Cadillac's passenger cars.
Yes.
He felt that his engineers had done a great job wringing performance from the brand's front-wheel drive models, but they simply couldn't match the ride and handling of Mercedes and BMW rear-wheel drive offerings. Moving to rear-wheel drive would also mean that Cadillac wouldn't have to share its vehicle architecture with other GM models.
Nice.
It could be unique. It could thus be engineered exclusively for the luxury market. The weight distribution would be better, with no torque steer when accelerating, and his designers would also have more flexibility in styling vehicles. Smith finally got the okay from his bosses at GM, and in 1998, the Cadillac team got to work. But it would take 4 more years before the new vehicle, based on a completely overhauled architecture and built in a brand new assembly plant, could be introduced.
We got to ditch the North Star engine. That was like the famous crappy engine that they put in all those older Cadillac, like,
well,
four doors.
No, it wouldn't be ditched just yet.
Oh no. Oh no. Oh no. I'm reading ahead. Uh-oh. I spoke too soon. Sorry, guys.
While his new passenger car was gestating, Smith tried to revive Cadillac's reputation in other ways. First came the Evoque concept car, a two-seat convertible fitted with a supercharged Northstar V8 with 405 horsepower and 385 feet of torque.
There it is.
Cadillac hoped that a sleek new concept car would capture the auto industry's attention and communicate the company's new direction to dealers, media, and the public. Even as he was trying to reinvent the brand, Smith knew that he needed dealers to remain invested in the company and help keep Cadillac's loyal owners in tow. The Evoque debuted at the 1999 North American International Auto Show in Detroit. It showcased a host of advanced technologies and foreshadowed the distinctive chiseled designs of future Cadillacs. Reporters called it daring, almost radical. And over the next few years, the Evoque appeared all over the world, including auto shows in New York, Geneva, Dubai, Tokyo, and more.
I do remember being obsessed with this when I was reading Road and Track when I was a teen.
Yeah, I'm looking
at it. And now I'm looking at it. It kind of just looks like a Corvette made by Cadillac.
Oh, interesting.
So then Cadillac tried something even more radical, racing. In 2000, the company entered a car in the 24 Hours of Le Mans for the first time since 1950. That's crazy.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That is cool.
And then there's this
looks
other
like a
one.
Mattress with wheels.
It's totally different. That looks like.
That's cool.
They're almost running like a stock
that is
car.
Cool.
That's a stock car.
But the other one looks like a full prototype.
That looks really cool. I like that a lot.
The other one looks like a mattress with wheels.
It does.
Yeah. Le Monstre.
With little little headlights.
That's the name.
That's cool.
You have to swallow your tongue when you say it. Le Monstre.
Yeah.
Don't choke on it, though.
Oh, by the way, you can watch this on YouTube as well and see what we're talking about.
Yeah. You don't have to just imagine it.
You also don't have to pull over the side of the highway to Google what we're talking about. And you also definitely shouldn't do it driving. Don't know why I'm saying all of this. You've listened to podcasts before. Okay. In partnership with Riley and Scott Cars, Cadillac developed two bespoke race cars powered by twin turbocharged Northstar engines, each producing 650 horsepower.
Yeah, so not so lame, are they, Jimmy?
Okay, all right, I'm taking it back. If they put it in Le Mans, it must have been okay.
Even though Cadillac's prototypes finished the race in 13th and 14th place, which is still pretty good for the record, GM found the media coverage valuable enough that Cadillac participated again in 2001 and 2002.
That is a weird leap to not be known as like a big brand in the 90s and then to just jump into racing that quickly.
Yeah. Also kind of late. Like they haven't touched racing in quite some time.
50 years. Yeah.
And then they jump into this kind of.
But now, nowadays, like they were in Le Mans, their car is sick. They made a bid for F1. So they are still.
They're in IMSA, I believe.
Too. IMSA. Yeah.
That's
probably
really cool.
Get there. No,
they're bidding to be in F1.
Yeah. They actually just, Mario Andretti partnered
with
them.
Oh, that's right.
They built. They what?
I mean, they're like they keep blocking Andretti. They do not want him there, man.
So a big part of it was like that they don't have a factory in Europe.
Mm.
They just bought like a 48,000 square foot factory in the UK. So they're serious about it.
Yeah. No, I know. Yeah. I mean, of course he wants to do that.
Escalade money.
Yeah.
As the next Cadillac got closer to its debut, Smith faced a decision about what to call it. The Seville, DeVille, Eldorado, and even the Catera were among the most well-established models in luxury cars, which means they came with a built-in cachet. However, the suits at Cadillac were trying to position their new vehicles as something completely modern, and they worried that the media would negatively compare and contrast old Sevilles or DeVilles.
So this thing is crazy. Mm-hmm. What's coming up, I didn't know these letters stood for it, but this is really interesting.
Okay. They chose to pivot to a three-letter system reminiscent of European naming conventions while leaving the wildly successful Escalade alone. For sedans, the last two letters became TS for touring sedan.
Oh.
The first letter was adopted from old models, C from Catera, S from Seville, and D from DeVille, which meant that Cadillac's newest baby finally had a name, the CTS.
Isn't that funny that it's just Catera touring sedan?
Yeah.
It is.
Because I don't think of the Catera as like a particularly great name. No, to
yeah,
keep.
I wouldn't write home about that.
Yeah,
but that's cool. You say CTS, and you're like, oh,
I love the CTS. Mm-hmm. Even the STS is like
interesting.
Deece.
I learned something new today.
In the fall of 2002, Cadillac finally introduced the reimagined luxury sedan that was intended to challenge the BMW 3 Series and the Mercedes C-Class. It had been a long road.
They're doing a lot in 1998.
They really are.
Yeah,
yeah.
Back in February 1998. GM strategy board asked head designer Wayne Cherry to show them an art and science imbued Catera replacement. What are you laughing at?
Wayne Cherry.
Wayne Cherry.
Break.
Yeah. He quit his job on the strip of Las Vegas.
Truly. Truly.
So they basically asked this dude, Wayne Cherry, to show them a replacement in 90 days,
That's
which is
crazy.
Very fast.
Yep.
Under the gun, Cherry violated his own internal rules and gathered together the best designers from all of his studios, no matter which brand they were assigned to. By late March, not quite 60 days after the strategy board meeting, Cherry's team had completed a clay model.
That's crazy. That's turnaround time.
Bonkers, yeah. Dude.
Engineers and manufacturing experts worked alongside Cherry, picking up whatever details were necessary for budget estimates. The CTS quickly emerged as one of their most involved projects due to the new architecture, multiple body styles, and a new assembly plant. In May 1998, Cherry revealed a see-through fiberglass model to the GM board, which was met with rapturous applause.
That's so cool. There's a S2000 one that's in Japan that's very famous.
Like see-through fiberglass?
It's a whole see-through car.
Whoa.
That they used to present
that's
the S2000
cool.
project. Awesome. Very cool.
The CTS was approved for production that day. In early 1999, the same model was revealed to the press, and an equally excited response followed. Veteran auto journalist Jerry Flint commented,
"You know what that car says? It says, F you, I'm from Detroit."
All right. A little.
Wow, Jerry
a little
Flint.
Aggressive, Jerry, but.
Yeah, geez.
You said he was brash.
Yeah, I know. Mm. No, his words speak for himself.
Yes.
He's brash and bold.
Yeah.
Mm.
Despite mainly manufacturing front-wheel drive vehicles for the previous two decades, GM maintained pockets of expertise in rear-wheel drive as its European badge Opel and the American Corvette team. These consultants were brought in to ensure the new car's engineering was sound and to test their work on the demanding Nürburgring in Germany. That's sick. When the CTS finally hit the roads in 2002, it was every bit as successful as Cadillac and GM hoped it would be. Forbes called it
an Audi, Mercedes BMW type of car that is more than capable of satisfying the needs and desires of that customer base.
Nearly 38,000 CTSs were sold in 2002. That number grew to almost 53,000 in 2003.
Mm.
The success contributed to a 20% increase in total Cadillac sales.
Wow.
CTS sales volumes kept increasing through 2005, reaching nearly 67,000 cars sold. The CTS launch helped Cadillac climb back into consideration for many car buyers because entry-level luxury was the largest segment in the U.S. luxury vehicle market, as well as the most underserved by Cadillac.
Mm.
In 2003, Rick Wagoner wrote in Automotive News that,
"While it was sort of shocking in its boldness, it was, upon reflection, something that fit. It felt right."
All that tan leather.
Oh, perfect. So good.
It just fit.
That's all I think of this era is just like tan.
Truly.
Tan sedans with tan leather.
Mm-hmm. Horrible. The grandma spec.
Yeah.
Do you think Lincoln was like, oh shit, they got it right?
Probably.
Like at that time, they're just like, They're coming. Like they were probably like, oh yeah, we took them out of the market. They're making shit cars.
Mm.
And then this happened. They got the CTS and the Escalade. And they're like, damn. Yeah. We're in for a world of hurt.
No, that makes sense. From 2003 through 2005, Cadillac introduced at least one additional new model every year, as well as an updated Escalade. They were like, oh, this one guy did it in 90 days one time. Everyone's going to do this. Let's do it again.
Can you do that constantly?
Can you do that constantly? You know how you all killed yourselves? In 2003 came the XLR Luxury Roadster, a disappointingly watered-down version of the Evoque concept car.
Oh, is that what LR stands for? Extreme Luxury Roadster?
Oh.
Ooh, probably.
Not XLR cable.
No. Not the three-prong audio cable. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was a joke three people will understand.
Where are my audio engineers out there?
Hey, what do you want?
Are the levels okay?
Yeah, what about that 60 hertz hum?
So the XLR Luxury Roadster was built on the same platform as a Corvette, but had a smaller motor, leaving it less powerful and more expensive than its GM sibling.
I saw one of these driving on Manchester.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And it was like very well kept.
Oh, nice.
And I was like, I kind of get it.
Did they come in manual?
I think very rare, but okay. They did.
That would be cool to find a manual one. I remember when I came to the States and I was like, what the is that?
Oh, you saw one?
Well, I didn't know what it was. I was like, it's not a Corvette.
Yeah.
But I like just didn't get why. I always wanted to know the story about it.
It was Corvette from far.
Yeah.
Far from Corvette.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In 2004, the XLR was followed by the SRX crossover and CTS-V high-performance models. In 2005, the STS premium luxury sedan was introduced, finally replacing the Seville. Internally, Cadillac felt this car was important, helping to dispel concerns that the CTS was a one-hit wonder. Apart from the XLR, the new Cadillacs were largely acclaimed by critics and buyers. Cadillac's annual sales increased from a 32-year low of 173,000 cars in 1996 to nearly 250,000 vehicles by 2005. The CTS in particular proved to be a winner, literally. The second generation won Motor Trend's Car of the Year in 2008, and the third generation did the same in 2014.
Nice.
John Smith's art and science concept helped Cadillac get back to its roots of making uniquely styled cars that drove great. As the Los Angeles Times put it,
since its inception, the CTS has been a pivotal model for Cadillac, helping to lead a turnaround at the brand after years of turning outdated land yachts.
Oh.
Nice.
That's what an LA Times thing sounds like.
Oh, it's true. Yeah. It was good. However, by the 2010s, Cadillac once again failed to anticipate changing tastes. Specifically, they were slow to expand their luxury crossover offerings, which hurt U.S. sales once again. The company also suffered from the after effects of GM's bankruptcy in 2009, though at least it wasn't shut down like Pontiac, Oldsmobile, and Saturn.
Let's pour one out for the real ones, you know?
Yeah.
Oldsmobile! Mm.
If nothing else, the recent success of the Escalade and CTS kept Cadillac in business. Nevertheless, by 2019, annual U.S. sales had fallen to 175,000 cars, just barely topping the 1996 low point of 173,000 right before the Escalade was introduced. But nowadays, despite plummeting American sales, Cadillac is far from dead. Quite the opposite. Rising popularity in China has offset Cadillac's reduced American sales. Like Hollywood, honestly. Sorry. In 2017, Cadillac sold more vehicles in China than it did in the U.S. for the first time, contributing to a new global sales record, which it then surpassed in 2018 and again in 2019. In 20-some years since John Smith left Cadillac for a corporate role within General Motors, Cadillac has had 12 different leaders. GM is now 50-50 partners with Cadillac and a Chinese company called SAIC, School of the Art Institute of Chicago.
Oh, I love those guys.
Yeah, yeah. New leaders, new partners, and new markets bring new expectations, all of which will influence the next generation of Cadillac cars. The new Cadillac Lyriq EV shows the company is listening to market trends and testing out new technology, which is a selling point for caddies in the 50s and 60s. And the massively expensive $300,000 Celestiq is a huge swing in the hyper-luxury market dominated by European companies like Bentley, Rolls-Royce, and Maybach.
The Celestiq.
Celestiq.
It's got a big butt.
It is a huge butt. Did you look it up?
I did look it up.
It's also like fully electric. It's very fast. And I saw one in person and it looks really cool inside.
Yeah.
It looks very like they are going for the Rolls-Royce crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting looking. It looks fast.
Yes.
You know, it looks like they kind of like drew a car and then they blurred the end of it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they have the same process that they have with like Bentley, where you can go in and have whatever, be whatever color, whatever fabric.
That's cool.
Full customization.
Customization is really cool.
That is cool.
It looks very 30s. Like it does look like
Art Deco-ish.
Yeah, very Art Deco.
Yeah, I agree.
I like it.
So the mere fact that Cadillac has wiggle room to try out vehicles like the Celestique is a sign that they still have momentum more than 120 years after the first car rolled off the factory floor. But the future has no guarantees, gentlemen.
Oh, no. You just pumped it up so much.
No, I pumped us up and I'm bringing us down. Cadillac's long history proves that. The direction of a company can change in the blink of an eye, and today's most popular vehicle may be out of style within a few years. But anytime Cadillac makes a great car that looks awesome, you can't count out another comeback.
Oh, okay.
So it might go down or it could go up.
Who knows?
Or it might go down or it could
go up. We just got to cover all bases. So if it goes out of business tomorrow, we can say, I told you so. Mm-hmm. And if they do well tomorrow, we can say, I told you so.
Man. Yeah. We like being right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I have a new appreciation for Cadillac.
I do too.
I really liked this.
Yeah. This was great.
Really nice to learn. I truly don't think about them. You know what I mean?
I don't think of them. Yeah. And like, I just looked at their lineup because I was like, other than the CTS, which is now the CT5, has been replaced by the CT5. I don't really know their lineup. And they all have that European naming convention, like the XT4, CT4. Yeah. The Blackwing, I know about that. That's a cool car.
Yeah, their performance cars are really cool.
Super cool. And actually, Hennessy makes a Blackwing that makes like 1,000 horsepower. It's insane. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure they're great cars nowadays.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They really have a hold on the sedan market, which a lot of companies are not really going for right now.
No. Luxury sedan, too.
Yeah, luxury sedan.
That's U.S. made. A lot of Texas guys like this car.
Yeah.
You're a Texan, you like a Cadillac.
We have some listener mail from the opposite of Texas, Minnesota, this week. Jimmy, do you want to read it?
Sure.
Yay.
Hey guys, it's Wayne here from way up north in Tower, Minnesota. Just wanted to say, I love your podcast and YouTube channel. I listen daily. I don't have a road trip snack to send you. But have you thought about low-carb gummy bears? They are fruitfully delicious, and also being low-carb gives a little pass gas for your other occupants. I think it's a snack that goes greatly with the show and a road trip. Lots of laugh and lots of gas. Keep it juiced.
Thanks, Wayne.
Wait, Wayne Cherry? cherry gummy bears?
Follow the money.
Follow not only the money, but follow Jimmy on Instagram at russelljimmy.jpg.
And follow
Christina at Christina Felsky.
Yes.
And I have been Joji Weber. Follow us all at Donut Podcasts and subscribe. Thanks to Greg Nix for writing this episode and the part one. Thanks to Audrey Holden for running audio. Being a great producer. Thanks to Edgar Grajeda for running the cameras. We love our crew. We love everyone at Donut. And we'll see you next week.
Gabagool. Bye-bye.
Oh, no. My gabagool has been hanging out this whole time. I'm sorry.